So I think that's the biggest thing. You know, what are your stress tests telling you on this loan? We're finding out right now, look what's happening with interest rates. I don't know where they're going. You don't know. Nobody listening to this knows where they're going. We could be sitting here a year from now and interest rates might go right back down. Okay. I mean, who knows?
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Todd Dexheimer has bought and sold over $150 million of investment real estate and currently owns over $100 million multifamily and senior assisted living in five different states. His focus is on syndicating value-add senior housing and multifamily properties. Todd, welcome to the show.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Excited to get going.
Pleasure's mine. Three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show in 90 seconds or less. Where did you start? Where are you now? How did you get there?
Yeah. Well, started as a high school shop teacher and just reading books, man. I knew I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. So I started reading books and really dove in, started buying little properties, started buying single families, duplexes, quads, and then just worked my way up. I flipped about 150 houses in transition. And while I was flipping those houses, I was keeping a bunch too as rentals. So I built my rental portfolio in about 100 units, flipped houses. And then finally I was like, okay, what do I want to do? Where do I want to go? How do I want to scale this thing? And started transitioning then into multifamily, larger multifamily and all multifamily and assisted senior assisted living.
That's wild. So did you do the 150 houses while still being a shop teacher?
No, I started while still being a shop teacher, but two years in is when I quit. So I was a high school shop teacher in 2008, 2009, and then I quit at the end of the 2009-2010 school year. I just said, hey, I'm done. I went part-time, actually, because I couldn't convince my wife. Now, it's just because I wasn't very good at negotiating, apparently, at that time. But I couldn't convince my wife to quit my job. And I tried to, and she's like, no, you told me this wasn't going to be, you know, full-time type of thing. And so I went part-time, and that worked out really well. And then the next year, I said, hey, I'm going to quit. And long conversations, but we actually went to church, got out of church, and the pastor had like this perfect message about, you know, taking risk, following your dreams, that type of thing. Out of church, and we're literally driving down the road, and we probably are like 2 miles, not even 2 miles. We're sitting in a stoplight. My wife, we're not looking at each other. We're not talking, nothing. And she goes, you can quit your job. Just show me the numbers. Okay, perfect. Thank you, Pastor John. Appreciate you.
That's awesome. Yeah. Hey, man. And the best ideas are the ones that other people come up with on their own like that. Like, you didn't even have to fight for it. It's like, okay, cool. Yep. It was handed to you. That's a lot of houses to flip. When did you finally say enough was enough?
I think my last flip during that era was done and sold in 2015 or 16. I can't quite, I'd have to go back to like the books and look, but yeah, right around 2000, let's call it 2016 to be safe. I just flipped a house. I hadn't flipped a house since then. A house came gift wrapped to me by one of my friends who's like, hey, I got this property. Do you want to flip it? And I kind of was about, I really was like, no, I don't. I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'll take a crack at it. So I just flipped and sold just last week. We actually successfully closed on it, but I'm not going to become a flipper again. If it's a deal that kind of falls in my lap, I'll do it. Other than that, I'm not going
to
do it.
I hear you, man. I'm guilty of the same. I'm glad to hear there's somebody else out there that has the same disease I do. Yeah. Because actually where I'm standing right now recording this is a house that someone gift wrapped and they were like, hey, you want to buy this? Like, yeah, I guess. I mean, sure. It sounds great. But otherwise, I'm not buying single family houses. I hear you, man. That's awesome. You've done some really cool projects. I mean, since 2016, and I happen to know a few projects here in my own hometown that you have worked on and own currently that are some really probably things that even a lot of value add multifamily operators wouldn't touch. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, I would say most value add investors wouldn't touch. These are more than value adds. These are what I would call a reposition, especially the one property. It's a 122 units. It's a mid-rise building built in the 60s. And this thing just, it hadn't really been touched. It feels like since the 60s, you know, there's some stuff that probably hadn't been touched. I shouldn't say probably, I know for sure that hadn't been touched since it was built, but there was a lot of stuff that really was just in disrepair, very poor condition overall of the property. You know, walking into units and you're seeing bathroom tiles falling off of the walls. There was a lady who had just moved in maybe a few months before. We're doing the walk or full inspection. I walk into her unit and I'm looking around and I open the shower curtain and there's this stack of like 10, 12, 15, whatever it was, tiles stacked up on the tub. And I said, what's this about? And she goes, oh, here, look. And there's missing tiles everywhere. This lady just moved in, and that was pretty common. You know, we'd walk in and, hey, do you have any problems? Well, this and this and this and these 18 things don't work. Or, you know, here, look at this or look over here. And so it was a project that, quite frankly, was pretty intimidating. But at the same time, we looked at what was going on in that submarket and really got excited about what some of the other properties had been able to do. It was a property literally kitty corner from where we are, and it had sold for a very attractive amount. They were getting very attractive rents, and we had secret shopped it. We had looked and, you know, pretended we were potential tenants, and we were really impressed. And so we thought, could we do the same thing that they did to that property, do it at this one? And that's what we're in the, well, I would say the finishing stages of completing. Actually, we're already exceeding our rents. We are hitting our year three pro forma already. And so, yeah, it's been fun. It's been crazy. Pandemic, all that kind of stuff. Crazy inflation, obviously. And so it's just been a wild ride. Sam, we've learned so much along the way. It's just unreal. But it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, not only just the events that you, pandemic, inflation, things like that, that are external events. I mean, you're dealing with a building from the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's not just any building from the 60s. I mean, it's kind of almost, it almost has a very historic look.
Well, that's probably maybe even more of the other one. So the other one is 1938.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
Then. That's the one that you're maybe thinking of. So that one is the 1938 building, very historic. It is in a historic district of the city, and it's got a very strong neighborhood community, so they're paying attention. Right. So you got to be careful what you do. And so that one, a little bit less of a renovation that we're doing to it, but still pretty sizable renovation, more stable of a building, less of that, you know, nasty. I would say some stuff has been updated, some stuff hasn't, but that one's a big value add as well. The first building I talked about, I think we're putting about almost 40,000 a unit into. Wow. That's exterior interior. So 40,000 per unit times 122. The other one we're putting roughly 30,000 a unit into, exterior interior. And we're trying to do a couple things like add a pool, add some parking, but those are big items that we're getting a lot of pushback from the community. They don't want us to do that. And it kind of defies common sense, but it just is what it is.
Right. Yeah. Those are things when you get into dealing with historic societies or historic buildings, and then you got, you know, 25 people looking over every last thing you do down to the paint color, and you're like, what in the world am I dealing with? You mentioned that the mid-rise building that you guys did from the 60s, you know, you learned just a ton of lessons, you know, on that project. Can you break maybe some of those two or three kind of higher level lessons down? You'd say, man, these are some monster takeaways that we are really looking out for on the next one that looks just like this.
Yeah. So one of the things that we have now implemented on this second project, this 1938 building is just down the road, and we bought that quite a while after the first one. And so one of the things that we learned is just the clear communication between our expectations, our project manager and the contractors. We need to make sure everybody's on the same page. And by the way, our staff that's in the building working. So our leasing staff and our maintenance staff. So we've created now this very detailed construction dashboard to make sure materials are being ordered on time, to make sure that, you know, countertops are being ordered to be installed at the right time, to be able to make sure that, you know, the keys have been given to the contractor at the right time, all that kind of stuff. Now we have this detailed construction dashboard where it's just like, here are the steps. So every single week you need to be logging in. And you need to be looking at that dashboard. And a lot of times it's more than once a week, but you need to make sure you're updating it and following along. And if there's a check mark in here, that could mean that you need to go, oh, you know, Ashley put this check mark here. That means it's my job to put the next check mark in. And if there's no check, fine. But if there's a check there, you got to go, okay, now it's my job next. Right. And I have to follow through. And that way everybody's held accountable. So I think that's the biggest thing that we have implemented now that we didn't have before. The next thing is I don't want to start renovating if I don't have a clear path forward. And so when we started this first building renovation, we maybe didn't know every little last detail. And we thought that was okay. We will get those details figured out as we go. All that did was it allowed us to start the project, but it made the project start, made the vacancy start to go up, but it didn't allow us to progress where we should. Mm. Let's keep our occupancy as high as possible for as long as possible. Once we hit the start button, let's make sure that we're moving forward quickly and efficiently. What we forget a lot of times, and this is, I'm guilty of this. I think a lot of people that are doing renovations are guilty of this. We go, I need this done on budget. And it might take me a little bit longer, but I got to get this done on budget. Okay. But think about this. We are renting these units for, you know, $1,200 to $1,400 a unit. Some of the smaller ones are less, but we're renting it for, let's call it $1,200 on average a unit. Well, if I've got one unit vacant for 1 month, that's $1,200. If I got 10 units vacant for 1 month, that's $12,000.
Right.
If I need to spend an extra $12,000 to get that project done a month quicker, it's well worth it because it's time, right? It's losing that time. So there's a big incentive with time velocity. Mm. You know, your velocity of money, you hear it all the time, your velocity of money makes a big difference. We want to get this project done as quickly as possible. Yes, we want to get it done on budget, but I would rather go over budget and get it done quicker with high quality, right? As long as the quality is good, but I want to get it done quicker than slower. So really think about what opportunity cost is costing you.
What are things that you find? I mean, it's one thing to say that, and then you got to have a place though to deploy that extra capital in order to speed things up. So what are some levers you can pull besides saying, hey, general contractor, we'll pay you, you know, whatever, 10% over your bid to get this done a week early or whatever it is. Like, how do you effectively, you know, use that extra capital to speed things up?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would say it comes down to, in the very beginning, being very mindful of what things are going to cost. Locking in pricing as soon as it is, as possible, as early as possible. Material pricing and labor pricing as quickly as possible if you can lock those prices. Mm. Especially in a quick moving market like today, where prices are fluctuating literally on a daily basis.
Right.
We want to lock in quick. We want to get contracts signed early and right away. That's number one, get your budget in order. Number two is have a very nice, cushy reserve budget. Make sure you're not penny pinching. The easiest way to make an investment look attractive is to lower the amount of money you have to put into it.
Right.
So a lot of investors will go, hey, we can get this budget. We can get this, you know, project done for $3 million, $5 million, whatever it is. And they go, okay, we're going to budget $5 million. Right? For a $5 million project, because that looks good. Like, we don't have to bring any more money to the table. But what we're going to do is, if we got a $5 million project and that's a big lift, we're going to put an extra like $1 million to the side. So we have plenty of cushion there to be able to pay for extra material costs, extra labor costs. We have time delays. Now we've got to paid more debt service than we were planning on. You know, we've got all kinds of issues that could pop up. I want to make sure I've got an extra, you know, 20, 25% sitting there ready to deploy if we need to.
I like that.
Again, especially in a volatile market like this.
Yeah, I mean, that makes all the sense in the world. And yeah, we do. You certainly do see a lot of that where the underwriting just doesn't include a lot of excess capital. And for you guys, it's not that it's as good as spent, because you can always return that capital back to your investors if you don't use it, right? But it's as good as spent on the front end if you go ahead and raise it early, because it's, hey, it's already been built into the expenses. Like this is already baked in as capital raised. It's as good as gone, in the sense that it's not going to affect the performance of the project by having that excess capital there.
Right. We are closing on a 228 unit building. By the time this goes out, we'll have closed on that building. The renovation budget is just a hair over $5 million. Hmm. And we have raised, so that's a construction loan, right? So we're getting a construction loan to be able to do that project. We're financing part of the construction, but we've also raised in just pure cash an extra $1.3 million. Just pure cash. And that way our bank accounts are flush. Like you said, we're not going to, like, that money is sitting there. And once we're in a better position, as we continue with the renovation, if we're going, hey, we're really on budget, we're 8 months in, we can see we're going to hit our budgets, we might be able to take and deploy $500,000 back to the investors. And then when the construction's completely done or very, very close, maybe we can do another $500,000 back to the investors. And so we can give that money back to them, but it protects our downside. That's the biggest thing you got to look at as an investor, especially if you're taking other people's money. How can I protect the downside risk?
And that's what we're hearing so much right now is, I mean, I'm hearing two, kind of getting two schools of thought here. There's people that are swinging for the fences and not really protecting it. And then there's a lot of people that are going, waving the flag of, all right, what are we doing right now to just not lose money? And it's a tricky balance there to go, okay, what are we doing not to lose money? But yet at the same time, finding a proactive way to go out and continue to take down projects that produce revenue. It's an interesting thing. Talk to us about the financing on that, taking out a building loan. What are some nuances there on the downside risk side? Because it's not a permanent loan. It's not a long-term financing. Yeah. How are you working that out and building that in?
Yeah, so there's certainly risk there. Anytime you take a construction type loan or bridge loan or local bank where they're providing the financing, you are certainly taking on more risk. And that's just part of the equation that you have to look at. So how much equity do you feel like you're building? Of course, that's still pro forma, right? So that we're projecting how much equity we're building. Do we feel like when the project's all done, we will have an ample amount of equity to where we can do execute a refinance or a sale and look pretty good? And then we want to stress test that. What happens if cap rates go up by, you know, 1 basis point a year, 5 basis points a year, or, you know, 3, or where is that all crap point, right? We want to figure that out. And how comfortable do we feel? I want the oh crap point to be where I look at that and go, huh, well, a lot would have to be messed up for that to happen, right? And of course it can still happen, but I want to laugh at it, right? I want to be, if I go, ooh, I could see that happening. Well, that's right. A property I need to walk away from.
Right.
If I look at it and laugh and go, huh, man, the chances of us getting there, slim to none. Well, that's good, because slim to none can still happen.
Yep.
But at least I think, okay, this project's got some legs to it. So I think that's the biggest thing. You know, what are your stress tests telling you on this loan? We're finding out right now, look what's happening with interest rates. I don't know where they're going. You don't know. Nobody listening to this knows where they're going. We could be sitting here a year from now and interest rates might go right back down. Okay. I mean, who knows? Back in, what was it, 2018, interest rates all of a sudden went up to like 5%, and then they went way back down. So that could happen again. But interest rates could also be at 8% in a year from now. And if they're at 8% and I got this bridge loan that I've got to refinance into permanent debt, what does that stress test look like? How is that going to affect my investor returns? And what are we going to be okay? or are we going to be screwed? If we're going to be screwed, I don't want that deal. Now, we can never predict, like, if interest rates go up to 20%, we're screwed. Like, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But if they're at 8%, can we live with that? Right. Are we okay? Do we have enough equity to refinance? Do we have enough cash flow to be able to still breathe? So that's the type of thing we're looking at. But certainly you've got to be able to swallow the extra risk. A permanent financing is for sure the better financing as far as safety,
right.
But it doesn't always make sense with the project, especially if you're doing a big reposition. Mostly it can't work.
Got it. Todd, it's been a blast. Thanks for coming on the show today and really just giving the breakdown on some of the really cool projects that you guys are working on. Again, they're right here in my own hometown. And I actually saw those get taken down. And I'm like, I wonder who that guy is. And then come to find out here a few months later, I'm like, oh, it's Todd. That's really cool.
Well, hey, man, I'm going to be in town soon. So we'll have to bring you through those buildings if you want to take a little tour and maybe grab a bite to eat.
Always. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that'll be a blast. I look forward to that. Todd, if our listeners want to get in touch with you and learn more about you and what you guys are doing, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Yeah, certainly reach out to me anytime. My website is EnduriusCapital.com. It's EnduriusCapital.com. They can reach me too just through my email, Todd@EnduriusCapital.com. And happy to connect, happy to talk to anybody about investing or whatever they want to talk about. So
certainly appreciate it, Todd. Thanks for coming on the show today. Have a great rest of your day.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.